This is David's Book Talk, bringing authors and book lovers together in a unique way since 2009. Visit us at davidsbooktalk.com and join the conversation at facebook.com/davidsbooktalk. But first, pull up a chair, relax, and enjoy today's episode. Here's your host, David English.
Hello and welcome to David's Book Talk. And boy, we have a special author today. Yes, his name is Joe Hill, and he has written a new book called The Fireman, and it's just out from William Morrow. Hello.
Hi, Dave. How are you?
I love the way you call me Dave. Nobody ever calls me Dave. <It's great. laughs> I don't know why. Because my name on the site is David, so I guess they figured that should be called David. I don't know. They're just trying to be respectful.
Yeah. Well, I should be. Maybe I should call you Mr. English.
Even better. I like that.
Do you think with a last name like English, you were going to do a book talk show?
I never even thought about it. I knew. And people think I'm really good with English, and I guess I am. But I never even thought of doing a book talk show until I heard these two ladies on AM radio having so much fun, and I called them. And next thing I know, they wanted me to be a part of it. That's what happened.
I do think sometimes names can be destiny.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, I mean, think about all the mediocre middle inning pitchers who have names like Ball Four.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Well, that's strange, isn't it?
I mean, you really never know what you're going to get.
And that makes it more fun, I guess, too. Except you can't. Yeah. It's hard to remember these weird names sometimes.
Yeah, well, I mean, baseball names are the best.
Now, are you as big a baseball fan as your father?
I went through a period of about a decade when I was fanatical, when I watched probably 150 out of 162 games.
Wow.
And I lived in Boston for several years, and I would sometimes see as much as, you know, 20 or 25 games a year.
Mm-hmm.
So I was pretty crazy. My period, my grand period for Red Sox fanaticism runs from the last couple years of Mo Vaughn to the 2004 World Series.
Wow.
After 2004, in 2005, my first book came out, and I was also a young father.
Right.
And at that time, I reached a point of diminishing resources and didn't really, I sort of tuned out of baseball. And like, if you asked me now, I couldn't tell you who the Red Sox starting five are.
Yeah, me either.
Pretty sad state of affairs.
And I was watching last night, actually, a clip of the Red Sox game, and they have these brown jerseys now. I'm like, brown? That's not Red Sox. Brown? And it was weird.
Was it a historical day? Were they doing some kind of, like, throwback uniform day?
It might have been. See, I the sound was turned down. I was in a restaurant, so I don't know. I didn't get to hear what was going on, but I thought, brown? I've never seen them brown before. It just looks so
odd. I know that David Ortiz is in his last year, and
right.
He's hitting everything in sight, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, the fireman could be a book about him, the tear that he's on.
Exactly.
You know, he's like he's lighting fire at everything he touches.
This book, The Fireman, is such an unusual book. I mean, I don't even know how to describe it. How would you describe it?
All right, I'll take a swing at it. So, it's hard to get. Once you start with the baseball metaphors, it's hard to get away.
Right. Oh, I love baseball.
The Fireman is a plague novel. It's a story about a runaway pathogen called Draco Incendia Trichophyton, but the colloquial name for it is dragon scale. It's a fungal infection, and there's no cure for it. And it gets on you, and it's actually quite beautiful. It marks your body with delicate black stripes that have gold flecks in them. But when you're anxious, when you feel stressed, those stripes begin to smoke. And if you can't control your anxiety, you burst into flames and die of spontaneous combustion. And so hospitals are burning in every city, and neighborhoods are going up in smoke. The whole globe has been seized by this enormous catastrophe that's almost impossible to combat because, you know, not only are the patients dying, it's hard to research something when not only are the patients dying, but then they're taking the doctors with them as the operating theaters go up in smoke. And so my story focuses on one young woman, Harper Willows, who is both infected and pregnant. And she's a medical person, she's a nurse, and she's done enough reading so she knows if she can survive to deliver her baby, the child will probably be born healthy.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what she resolves to do, and that's the story.
I love hearing the author talk about the book, doing a nice, succinct... for some reason, it's just fun to listen to. Because, you know, some authors, you know, go into detail, and others can do it so well. It's like, they've done this before.
Yeah, well, I mean, the other thing is that, you know, I'm a week into the U.S. book tour, and so I've had some practice now at you know, blithering away about what this thing is about. If you ask me to be articulate on almost any other subject, I just stammer and make vague grunting sounds. But on this, anyway, I'm certainly well prepared to discuss it.
Exactly. We should mention, just in case nobody knows, you're Stephen King's son. I just want to get that out of the way. So there are people out there saying, "Well, what's he talking about? Who's his father?" So
people don't always know that. The thing about my dad being a big Sox fan, right?
Exactly.
Not something I've actually gone out of my way to advertise, even though it's been fairly common knowledge the last few years.
Right.
I write as Joe Hill. The Fireman is, you know, is by Joe Hill, and I've had other novels. And when I was 18, 19, I always knew I wanted to be a writer. But when I was 18, 19, I became very anxious about publishing because I had this idea that I might publish not very good stories that would get published because I had a famous dad.
Right.
And I, for my own confidence, I needed to know when I sold a story that it sold for the right reasons, because an editor really dug it and thought readers would like it too. So I dropped my last name and I kept it secret about my parents and my family. I was able to keep it a secret for about a decade. And I collected a lot of rejection letters. That helped. That helped keep it secret. You know, nothing helps you stay under the radar like failure.
Yes.
So I wrote all these novels I couldn't sell and a lot of short stories I couldn't sell. But then I found a groove and I started to write short stories that people did like and that won prizes and got in some decent literary journals. I had a big breakthrough when I sold a Spider-Man story to Marvel Comics.
Oh, good for you.
And for me, that like put me on the top of the world. I'm like, I finally am someone. Yeah. I wrote Spider-Man. And eventually I sold a book of short stories to a very small press in England after the book had been turned down in New York and turned down in London, but this one guy took a chance on it in England. That was in 2005. That book was called 20th Century Ghosts. And that was the big breakthrough I had always kind of been hoping for, and then not long after that, the pen name started to melt apart, because as soon as I had a book to sell, I had to go on the road to talk about it, and I look like my dad. I mean, people saw me and said, "Hey, doesn't he kind of look like?" And my dad has a lot of fans, and some of them were aware that The Shining was dedicated to a Joe Hill King.
Right.
And so I was figured out pretty quickly after my first book came out.
God, The Shining was dedicated to you? How wonderful! Oh,
yeah.
But you write so well. I mean, your book Horns.
Thank you.
I was in the hospital when I was reading your book Horns, and it just got me through what I was going through. It was such a monumental thing for me. And it's true. I actually had your book in the hospital, and it, and I was going through a rough time. I mean, I had this big guy giving me shots every morning. You know, and it was quite, you know, scary at times. You know, when you're in the hospital, you never know what's going to happen.
Well, I don't know that Horns. I don't know that I would describe Horns as comfort food.
Yeah, but it was for me. I don't know why. It's just weird how some books are. Even though it is a weird book. I mean, all your books are weird. Aren't they?
Well, that's true. That's true. And Horns is probably the weirdest of them. Horns, for people who don't know, Horns is a story about a guy who drinks too much one night and goes out and curses God, and he wakes up the next morning to find he's growing horns out of his temples. This has actually happened to me 3 or 4 times.
Really?
And that's one of the reasons why I scaled back on drinking. But in any event, so he, my hero acquires all the powers of the devil, and he uses them to hunt for the person who murdered his girlfriend. And it was actually made into a movie a couple years ago starring Daniel Radcliffe.
Right.
And that was pretty cool. That came out really nicely.
Now, did that come out on video, or was that in the theaters, too?
Well, it was in a couple theaters, but so briefly that if you blinked, you would have missed it.
Right.
You know, we reach a kind of interesting stage in terms of pop culture and what's happening in cinema. I think a lot of people decry the death of independent film and feel like, boy, there's nothing in the theaters except for superhero films. But that's not really fair or true. Probably independent film is healthier now than it's ever been because there are so many amazing outlets for it. It's just the local independent movie theater is closed, and now that theater is your living room.
Exactly.
And you get those movies, those weird little indie films like Horns, you know, on Netflix or Hulu or Amazon or through iTunes. And if they don't cost too much, they more than make their money back and have a chance to start a discussion and find their audience, which may not be enormous, but may be very passionate.
Exactly.
So, I mean, Horns, the film, is it's sort of very David Lynch. It kind of has a Blue Velvet, Twin Peaks vibe to it.
Right.
It's not for everybody, but I do think that some people have found it terrifically enjoyable, and certainly Dan Radcliffe acted his heart out. So did Juno Temple, who plays his beloved in the movie. They're both tremendous.
Wow. I love the way you throw pop culture references in your books. I just love that. I mean, all of a sudden you'll just read about something. Oh, what, he's mentioning the Kardashians or whatever. You haven't mentioned them yet, but I.
Yeah, you know, the thing about that is, I read somewhere someone was talking about some movie that takes place during the zombie apocalypse, and he said at this point, the silliest thing about these movies is the idea that when the zombies start wandering around, no one knows what's happening. There have been so many zombie TV shows and so many movies, everyone would know what was happening.
Right.
You know, everyone already has their plan. It's an overused. So at this point, you know, I feel like when you put someone in a fantasy supernatural thriller, I always want to sort of play with what came before and what influenced me.
Mm-hmm.
And admit that these are characters who live in a world that's full of weird pop culture and, you know, apocalypse stories and stories of the supernatural, and people have had time to sort of develop ideas about what that experience should be like.
I'm very curious, and I haven't seen anything about it. What your dad thinks of your books? Does he like them as much as I do?
Well, you know, I come from a family of writers. It's not just my dad.
Yeah, that's true.
My mother, Tabitha King, has written several remarkable novels about blue-collar life in Maine.
Small World was one, wasn't it? Yeah.
She's Small World, right. A One-on-One, Book of Reuben, Pearl. I think Book of Reuben is particularly extraordinary.
Hmm.
Really, really fine novel. And so is One-on-One. And my brother, Owen King, he writes as well. I know that I'm biased and that people take this with a grain of salt, but I genuinely think that Owen's novel, Double Feature, is one of the funniest novels of the last 10 or 20 years.
Wow.
I laughed reading it in a way books never make me laugh. It's really hard to squeeze a laugh out of me when I'm reading something, and I just about wet myself reading Owen's book. So I love that. Owen's wife, Kelly Brassett, writes these deliciously sick and twisted crime novels, and I think her last one, Save Yourself, was especially mighty in terms of what it was doing and what it was exploring. So the whole family writes, and we all care about books and writing and bookstores and mm-hmm. publishing, and that's what we talk about when we get together. That's what we're interested in. If we're not dishing about books or ideas or stories, or, you know, then we're playing Scrabble, and that's pretty much what we do when we hang out. So
terrific.
I do have this huge network of people to show manuscripts to and get feedback from,
right.
And we all share critical comments and suggestions and ideas. It's actually a sort of tremendously unfair advantage over other writers.
Is this your longest book yet? I mean, how many words is it? Do you know offhand?
Probably a couple pages longer than my last one, which was called NOS 482.
Oh, that's right. That was pretty long too, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, that was a pretty long one. And this is the last long one for a while. You know, two doorstop books back to back is probably good for a bit. My next book is going to be a collection of four short novels.
Oh, very cool.
It's going to be called Strange Weather. Right. And that'll probably be out. Three of the four are already written. I think that will probably be out next fall. Maybe spring 2018, but we're shooting for fall 2017.
Boy, that's really cool to hear you talk about. And this one took you almost 4 years to write. I see in the back of the book that you even mentioned that it took you...
I'd certainly written some pieces of it. You know, a few bits of it existed at least 4 years ago, and the opening scene of the book was actually in my head for over a decade. You've got this young nurse looking out her window and seeing a man staggering across a school playground, and he has smoke coming out of the sleeves of his army jacket, and then he collapses and ignites spontaneously, combusts, and I had that vision, I had that that scene in my head very clearly for at least a decade. I just didn't have a story to go with it.
Do you have a lot of dreams?
Dreams? Do I have a lot of... Yeah, I have pretty vivid dreams, but most of them don't inspire stories. They're pretty dull stuff.
dull dreams.
I have so many dreams. I have so many dreams about discovering that I'm back in school and that I'm a whole bunch of credit short for some degree that I decided I had to get. And it will hit me mid-dream that I'm in my early 40s and this is silly. I don't belong in school anymore.
Right.
You know, I can put this part of my life behind me.
Right.
And it's just depressing how often I have that dream.
Now, you seem like such a fun guy, and you look in the back cover of your book, in your fire engine, you look like you're having so much fun. You look like a little kid sitting in a fire engine. That's exactly what you look like.
Not, okay, in the jacket photo, I don't actually own my own fire engine.
No, you really?
you know, and if someone decided they wanted to give me one, I would probably turn it down. Now, in Nosferatu, in the last book, the heroine, Vic McQueen, drives a Triumph Bonneville, a 1968 Triumph Bonneville.
Right.
And if Triumph decides they want to thank me for giving the hero that bike by giving me a bike, I would accept.
Right.
That would be okay.
But you wouldn't accept the fire.
I don't really need a fire truck cluttering up the yard.
But it's just funny how much fun you look like you're having in it, though. And it's just great. It's great fun to look at that and you think, oh my God, he does look like his father. It's like his father all over again, you know. It's so much fun. But you have such, you really know how to write. I mean,
well, that's a very kind thing to say. I do think it's, you know, my joke about the fireman is that it's a sunnier look at the end of the world. That
mm-hmm.
this is sort of the sunny apocalypse, you know, and there's a lot of really grim, dire, awful incidents in the book.
Yeah, I was going to say, it goes both ways, so, you know.
Well, that's the thing, though, is that there's also, I hope, anyway, that there's a lot of humor. And my heroine, Harper, and John Rookwood, who is the almost mythical fireman,
right,
who is this sort of hero to the infected, both of them are very stalwart and decent and good humored and play off each other in a little bit of a Holmes Watson kind of way, you know, and I did want to contrast Harper's basic decency and good humor and kindness with the horror of this great global crisis. Because one of the things you get in a lot of apocalypse stories is you see people reduced to animals, ready to claw each other's throats out for the
right.
last can of beans. And I accept that some people would do that. Some people trample children to get on the lifeboats on the Titanic. But I think that you also have to accept that that's not the full spectrum of humanity, and that actually decency, heroism, empathy, good humor, those are also hardwired into us. Yes, some people trampled children to get on the lifeboat on the Titanic, but also when the towers fell in New York City, some people were running up the stairs to see who they could save. When the bombs exploded at the Boston Marathon, there's footage of dozens of people running full out towards the explosions to see who they could provide aid to.
That's wonderful.
And so I did, in the process of writing this apocalyptic story, I did want to keep that idea, that vision of humanity up front, because I think that vision of humanity is very underserved in a lot of end-of-the-world stories.
You know, it's funny you mentioned the humor, because I was going to ask you about the humor. I can feel the underlying humor in this book, and I'm thinking, I wonder if this is also, does he consider this a very serious novel or a funny novel? And I, should I ask him about that, or will he get mad at me? You know, and that's what I'm thinking.
No, I mean, maybe, hopefully the book explores some serious questions and some important subject matter and themes, but you know, I've written three supernatural novels, and I've written this one big end of the world novel that's kind of like dark horror science fiction. And the truth is, in all those books, I take it seriously, but sometimes I it's very hard for me not to poke fun at myself and not to poke fun at the book within the story. And I think readers feel that and enjoy that they enjoy the feeling that we know the conventions of these stories, and I'm going to keep restlessly looking for ways to goof off on them.
Right.
For ways to subvert them and play with them and be a little silly with them.
Now, do you already have an idea for the next big novel at all?
Well, I'm steering away from. I actually have a 5-year plan, which will probably go out the window.
Whatever you want.
But I do have a very specific plan for what I'm working on in the next 5 years, and none of the projects that I've got lined up are for books on this scale. I've got this book of 4 short novels that I'd like to do next year.
Right.
I'm working on a TV adaptation of my comic, Lock and Key, and we're hoping to get that off the ground.
That's cool.
That would be really exciting. At some point, I've got 2 books I'd like to do, Strange Weather and another one, that there'll be another one after that that's partially written. I'm a comic book guy at heart, and I've done a lot of work in comics, and right now I'm taking some time off. But I have thought it would be great in 2 or 3 years to take a year and just be a comic book writer and write some comics that are, my own story, my own characters, my own ideas, so like an independent comic that I own myself,
mm-hmm.
but also work for Marvel and DC and do some of those licensed characters.
How cool is that?
Do Spider-Man for Marvel and do, I have a specific character for DC I'd like to do that I shouldn't mention, but do this that character for DC I always thought about writing about. And just be like an in-the-trenches working comic book guy. That would be fun.
Oh, it sounds like fun. It sounds like your whole life is fun.
it's in a good moment right now. I don't think anyone's whole life is fun, but I've certainly had more than my share of good luck, and I'm having a lot of fun.
But you're doing exactly what you like doing and what you're good at. So that's, in that essence, there is a lot of fun, isn't there?
Absolutely. Some people, I have been asked why I became a writer, since my dad is a really famous writer, and didn't I want to? But the thing is I always liked making stuff up, and I always liked writing a really good sentence inherently made me happy. I mean, just one good 2 or 4 word sentence makes me tremendously satisfied. And at some point in my early 20s, I think I felt like, I'll never be good at anything else the way I'm good at this. I may never be as good at it as my dad, but I'm still more than good enough at it to give people some fun.
Right.
And that seemed like a good reason to pursue it.
And you struggle with, as an interviewer, you struggle with these things. You think, should I mention his dad, or is he going to say, how's he going to react to it? Because everybody wants to be their own person. They want to do their own thing. And you have the talent, so there's no question about that. I mean, the books are really good and really. And I love the fact that you tackle a different subject every time, so I never know what's going to come next. I mean, there's some writers where I practically know what the story's going to be each time.
Right.
But you're not like that. You do something different, and that's exciting.
I do think that from a publishing standpoint, from sort of a brutal money-making standpoint, the publishers get really antsy every time you do something different.
Right.
Because the real money is in consistency, doing the same.
Well, what did they think about the firemen when you handed that in?
They were on board for it. I've been lucky in that I've had two terrific editors, my English editor and my U.S. editor, who have been very supportive of me taking chances and doing different kinds of books. But I think that overall in publishing, that's probably not too typical, and that both editors and marketing people, but also the writers too, you know, look for sort of one commercial angle you can grab, and then, you know, that's your life ring. That's what you hold on to keep from drowning. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think there's a lot to, you know, Robert Parker really didn't write much except the Spencer novels.
Right.
And most Spencer novels were like most other Spencer novels. You know, those are fun books, though. I love the Spencer for Hire books. You know, I'm not sorry that he didn't stretch his range, or that he stayed, you know, in a fairly narrow category of fiction. Because it takes me a while to do a novel, I'm not sure I'll be a super prolific guy.
Right.
You know, I think I counted once, and I figured out that in my whole life I'll probably be lucky to manage more than, you know, I'd probably be... If I managed to write 25 novels, that would be amazing, given my current pace.
Right.
And so that's few enough, so I feel like every novel should have something a little bit different about it from the last one.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, if I was sure I was going to write 30 or 40 books, probably I could write three or four that kind of fall into the same groove and sort of do the same things. That's not dishonorable. There's nothing wrong with that. It's
right.
Providing people with an expected pleasure.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, sometimes people just want a hamburger.
Exactly.
You know, I mean, nothing wrong with that. There's nothing.
Right.
But I think because I'm not likely to do, you know, I mean, probably I'll wind up writing 18 novels in all. And with that, I would like to make a few different kinds of dishes, you know, try my hand at a few different kinds of meals.
And that's what I like that. I like that you like to do different things. I mean, if it was all the same, I think I'd be bored.
Yeah.
To a certain extent. I mean, and I feel like you do. I like the Spencer books, but I did get bored with them after a while. I can admit that. And I'm sure...
Yeah, that's true. On the other hand, okay, so if I had to pick, like, you know, one writer that I particularly admire, and I talked about her in the front of the book, you know, I would say J.K. Rowling.
Right.
You know, that I just absolutely... I've read those Harry Potter books over and over again. The truth is that six of them are pretty much working from the same template, that the first six books in the series are essentially variations on the same melody.
Right.
And it only really shifts gears in the final book. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. Again, it can be that expected pleasure that,
right.
You know, falling into those patterns can be part of the fun.
I think you either connect with a book or you don't. I mean, that's how I
right.
feel. I mean, when I pick up a book, I either connect and I can get into it or I can't. It's one or the other.
Yeah. Yeah.
And maybe...
I always hope with my stuff that there will be a combination of that if people come back, it won't be because, you know, I'm working from one expected template, but hopefully that they like my voice, they like the way I write sentences, and will know that I'll try to keep things, I'll try to balance excitement and humor in a way that will make turning the pages pleasurable instead of feeling like homework.
Well, you have a very, very good outlook about that, and I think that's wonderful. And, you know, there's some writers that I read, and I just, they bore me, and I can't read them. And I could name a few, but I'm not going to. But, yeah, it's like, we all have those. But, you know, it's not like we're going to call them up and say, you know, we hate your writing. It's not going to happen, because I would never hurt anybody's feelings that way.
Yeah, I mean, I've read a couple. There's a feature in the New York Times Book Review called Buy the Book, and different people get asked about their reading habits, and one of the questions that gets asked over and over again is, what books have you read that you thought were disappointing or not just, you know, plain just not good?
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen a couple people say variations on, you know, I can think of some things, but I don't want to say it because I don't see any reason to shame someone publicly, you know, and I kind of feel that way, and I also kind of feel like just because I didn't dig something doesn't mean someone else won't.
Exactly. Yep.
You know, so let people find their way to their own pleasure.
So does it bother you that if people write to you and say they don't like your books, does that really bother you?
Well, I've been very lucky. I haven't had too much of that. Sooner or later, I'm going to write a book, and it's going to get shellacked by the critics. You know, I'm going to write something where I'm just going to get absolutely paddled. Because that's a career, because that happens. It doesn't even necessarily mean you wrote a bad book. It can be whatever you're doing fell out of favor for the moment. You know, I've read some really good books that got almost unanimously horrible reviews. But I've been lucky, and critics have always been really nice to me. And I've had a couple bad reviews, but there have been enough with every book. There were always enough good reviews, so I could be like, "Well, someone's enjoying it." You know, it never hurt that much. But if I had a book where I just got absolutely pounded, I don't know how that would affect me. That might be hard.
Your books are just always fascinating, though. That's what I like about them, and that's what I look forward to about them. And I'm being very honest here. I'm not just saying that because I'm interviewing. I really feel that way about you.
Oh, you're very kind. Thank you.
But, you know, reading is an unusual thing. You can love one book, and then you can pick up another book where 50 million people loved it, and you hate it. And
that's true. That's true. When it can be something, there can be something very, very random where you just say, nope, that I couldn't stand that main character. I know everyone else liked him. I hate that person because he did this, and I just can't accept it.
I mean, when I tell people I like The Bridges of Madison County, people yell at me for that. They say, "How could you like that book? I love the book, and it's never going to change. I'm always going to feel that way."
I read The Bridges of Madison County. I have tried to do. I'm not as good at it as my dad is. My dad reads almost everything that hits the bestseller lists. Whether he likes it or hates it, because he's always interested. He always wants to know why it was successful.
Right.
You know, and I sometimes think he has this little dissembling computer inside his brain. And when he reads a best-selling novel, he can instantly sort of run the autopsy and unpack it and see what made it live.
You know, how fast does he read?
Oh, really? He reads 80 books a year at least. Sometimes as many as 100.
Wow, that's terrific.
And I read about half that.
Right. Now,
in my defense, I have been raising 3 kids over the last, you know, over the last 2 decades. And, you know, now my kids are getting to be old enough, so they're pretty independent. I have a little more time to read.
But, oh, there you go.
But, you know, my dad is just, you know, my mom, too. My mom can fly through books.
Right. It's funny. You're like psychic, because I was just going to ask you about your family, and you started talking about your family. It's like, I didn't even have to ask.
They all read. I think that, I think Owen's wife, Kelly, I think she reads very quickly. You know, I think that it depends on what she's got going on in her life, but she could, you know, she could have a really difficult year and only read 24 books, but then the next year she could bounce back and read like 80.
Right.
I think my brother and I both read about 40 books a year.
You know what's really, and I have, the biggest problem I have is when I read a really great book to find another one after that. That's what I really suffer with that.
Yeah, I have a shelf in my house called the Shelf of 10.
Right.
And on it are the next 10 books I'm going to read in order.
Really?
And usually they're subdivided into little categories of like so right now I've got on the Shelf of 10, 5 of them are World War II books because I've just found a bunch of World War II books I meant to read. And the other 5 are books by female crime writers because there was this great, you know, this highly praised book, Women Crime Writers, the 1940s, which is about the women who were the contemporaries of Chandler and Hammett, but have largely been forgotten, even though they were playing the same game and arguably just as good. And so I'm sort of like my own instructor in these tiny little courses,
right.
You know, like female crime writers of the 1940s, or these little Jeopardy categories,
right.
Science fiction books about Adolf Hitler.
Right.
You know, so
that's terrific.
So my reading is kind of over designed. So I'm never really worried about the next book or how I'm going to follow a book up, because I just grab whatever's next on the shelf of 10.
There you go. I'm sorry I keep interrupting you. I'm so excited talking to you, and I do apologize. I'm a terrible interviewer because I keep interrupting the author, and people must think, what an idiot. He doesn't even know when to keep quiet, you know?
No, I don't think so. I think that's a conversation. Yeah. Normally, that's a conversation.
You know, you're right. I think you're right. I'd love to know what those 5 crime books are.
Well, I don't have the books with me. I wish I could tell you. project.
Now you got me curious.
Hotel room, but yeah, I mean, I think one is called East in View by Margaret Millar.
Oh, okay.
The other ones.
Oh, that's really cool. But I just a shelf of 10. Now I'm going to picture this shelf now.
Yeah, shelf of 10. Curating the shelf of 10 is a lot of fun.
I think we have to let you go, unfortunately. You're so much fun, Joe.
You really are. Well, terrific talking to you.
It was terrific talking to you, and I was nervous, but I had no reason to be. You're a terrific guy. And let's mention the book again. It's called The Fireman Itself, and William Morrow came out on the 17th, right, of May?
Yeah, and it's available in bookstores, independent. Your local independent bookstore has it. You can get it from the usual suspects online.
Right.
It's available in audiobook read by Kate Mulgrew. And, you know, you're not going to be satisfied just buying one. You're going to buy one for you, and you're going to want to buy, you know, one for a friend because it's really that good.
And I wanted to mention that, too. The book is beautiful, too, the way it's laid out. It's just a beautiful book. It's heavy, I give you, it's very heavy, but it's beautiful. I really love it.
Well, it's dual use. It's dual use. I mean, it's there to provide you with, to enrich you in terms of, you know, providing you with some great reading, but it's also there for home defense. So if someone breaks in, you can just start to club them with the book.
That's right.
And it'll drive them away because it's like hitting them with a brick.
That's true. Well, you do say hello to your father and your family to me.
I'll be sure to, and thanks so much for having me on.
Thank you. This has been David's Book Talk, and we'll talk to you next time.
You have just enjoyed the podcast of David's Book Talk, brought to you by your host, book lover David English. Please visit us at davidsbooktalk.com, follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and subscribe to our podcast. We want to hear from you, and we don't want you to miss our upcoming shows with top authors like Mary Higgins Clark, Patricia Cornwell, Lisa Scottolini, Jackie Collins, Nelson DeMille, Michael Connelly, Sue Grafton, Steve Martini, Dale Brown, David Baldacci.